Welcome to the Hanover Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hanover Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue his historical overview of the period from 66 AD to 1839. Then he'll begin tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hanover Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 4. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Okay, let's begin session number 4, lesson number 4 in our study, The First Regathering, Modern Israel. We've been in a section of background, an historical survey of the period. We've seen that from 66 to 1839, there was a continuous Jewish presence in the land. Then we began to look at that period of time in a little more detail. We looked at the period of time from 66 to 640. We call that the Roman period. After the Roman period, we came to the Arab period, 634 to 1099. That was followed by the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, the Crusader period, 1099 to 1291. Then from 1291 to 1516, the period of the Mamluks. And now we begin session number 4 with the time period of 1517 to 1917, which is the period of the Ottoman Empire. Now the Mamluk Empire, as we saw last session, was a pretty corrupt empire. It decayed from within. And while it did, the Osmanli Turks, better known as the Ottoman Turks, began moving up to the forefront of events in Asia. In 1453, Constantinople fell to their arms, and that brought an end to the eastern division, the eastern arm of the Roman Empire. In 1517, under the leadership of Selim I, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt were overrun by the Ottoman Turks. Now, in the beginning of the Ottoman rule, Syria and Palestine were rearranged for administrative purposes. Palestine, as it had before under previous regimes, did not form a single administrative unit. Jerusalem, Nablus, Gaza, Sidon, and Beirut constituted one unit, while Galilee became part of the Pashalik of Sidon. So Palestine wasn't a single political unit, as it had never been, and it wasn't under the Ottoman Turks either. Now, for defensive reasons, Suleiman the Magnificent, he lived from 1520 to 1566. For defensive reasons, Suleiman the Magnificent rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. They are said to be the same wall surrounding the old city of Jerusalem today. For the first 200 years of Turkish occupation, Palestine was ravaged by internal wars, incessant internal wars for the first 200 years. But there was no invasion from the outside. The very such invasion came at the end of the 18th century during the wars with Napoleon. Napoleon occupied Egypt in July of 1798, and then he crossed into Palestine at the beginning of 1799. He took Jaffa. He moved on to Tyre. He laid siege to the city of Tyre, but he failed to capture it. Jerusalem was never attacked. In June, Napoleon recrossed into Egypt, and in August of 1799, he left for Europe. Now, Turkish policy was favorable to the Jews in general. The Turks probably aimed to attract Jews. They wanted to attract Jews away from the oppression that the European countries had heaped upon them. And that would benefit the Turkish Empire. The Turkish Empire would benefit from Jewish economic activities. And as such, accordingly, Palestine received a good number of Spanish Jews when the Jewish community was driven out of Spain in 1492. Galilee was still the center of Jewish population in Palestine and Safed. Safed became the most important city where the Jewish community developed a thriving wool weaving industry. Safed also became the center of Jewish mysticism. In Safed lived Joseph Caro, a Spanish-born Jew who was raised in Turkey. Caro combined Jewish mysticism with a profound knowledge of the Talmud. He composed a work known as the Shulchan Aruch. This work was designed to regulate the daily life of the Jew in accordance with rabbinic teachings. Now, a Jerusalem Jew, Isaac Luria, also was very active in Safed. Under his leadership, the Zohar became and very, very important to Jewish mystics. Now, Safed had a Jewish population of some 15,000 by the middle of the 16th century. In addition, the city of Tiberias was rebuilt, and so Jerusalem occupied third place as the center of Jewish residence and intellectual activity during this period. Hebron also had a small Jewish community, but it was struggling for survival against a very powerful and hostile Muslim populace. So let me summarize now the period from 66 to 1839. During all of this period lasted nearly 2,000 years, during all of this period, Palestine was not even a name on the political map of the world. It was a portion of a larger province, whether it was a Roman, Byzantine, Arab, or Turkish control over the area. Palestine was just a portion of a larger area. The people who lived in, quote, Palestine were never conscious of themselves being a national unit, and they never attempted, as they had done earlier in the Israelite days, to form an independent kingdom. At no time in the recorded history of Palestine was the country one independent political state, except the one exception is under the Jewish community. Palestine's political identity was destroyed when the Jewish national homeland was destroyed. At the end of the 19th century, when the Jewish people began to return to the country, they returned with a renewed determination to rebuild our national homeland. When we returned in the 19th century, Palestine once more re-emerged from obscurity. It was just an obscure piece of territory for 2,000 years. Then in 1948, the State of Israel was reestablished, and Palestine became once again, after a lapse of about 2,000 years, an independent state. So that's our background, and that's the background we need to keep in mind as we study Zionism and the first regathering of modern Israel. Okay, let's move on to the third part of our study. Now, I'm not going to go through this class in kind of a traditional outline type of method. What I'm going to do is go through this class in the form of a timeline. I'm going to work down a timeline year by year, covering the important people and events in chronological order. Now, I'm doing this because I've taken previous courses of this nature, and the courses that I've listened to usually tackle the material topically rather than chronologically. And when that happens, I usually get very lost. When in the world did this happen? I lose my reference point regarding when that event or movement got started. For me, I need a starting point to orient myself. So I do better when I can see the events unfold step by step, one after the other. So, because I wished that others had taught this material to me chronologically, I thought that I would give it a try myself and that I would teach it chronologically when I had the opportunity. That's because that's the way I like it. I hope you like it too. Okay, we've surveyed the situation in the land of Israel from the first century until 1839. Now, in 1839, the beginnings of the modern Zionist movement begin to appear. This is our third major section of our study, the beginnings of Zionism. Let's start in the year 1839. We begin in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, with an Orthodox rabbi named Judah Alkali. Now, Judah Alkali was born at the end of the 18th century. Alkali was an obscure preacher in a little Sephardic community, Semlin, near Belgrade. In 1839, he astounded his congregants by publishing a Ladino Hebrew textbook called Darche Noam, Pleasant Paths. Darche Noam, Pleasant Paths. In the introduction, he alluded to the need of establishing Jewish colonies in the Holy Land as a necessary prelude to the redemption. He had later writings. The best known was called Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel. In his later writings, especially Shema Yisrael, Alkali noted that self-effort taken by Jewish people, in order to establish the redemption was justified by the very proof texts of tradition. In other words, he felt that Jewish people could work for establishing the redemption. They didn't have to wait for the coming of the Messiah. Now, the dominant view in Jewish life at that time was the view that the Messiah had to come first before Israel could return to the land. That's why he astounded his congregants. This was a brand new thought for the day. The old thought, Messiah had to come and bring in the redemption, and then we would return to Israel. But Judah Alkali said, no, we can begin now. We don't have to wait for the Messiah. Now, in 1840, a significant event occurred in Damascus that influenced his thinking very, very deeply, very much. In 1840, we have a Damascus blood libel. In 1840, the efforts of some influential Western Jewish leaders achieved the release of several unfortunate Jewish people imprisoned in Damascus on blood libel charges. Now, Alkali detected a miracle here. He detected a miracle of vigorous secular action, and he detected a precedent for the future stages of redemption in Palestine. He saw that secular action, vigorous secular action, could work miracles in his point of view. In 1843, he wrote a book entitled Minchat Yehuda, Offering of Judah, Minchat Yehuda. And in this booklet he declared, and I quote, "It is written in the Bible, Return, O Lord, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. But upon what should the divine presence rest? On sticks and stones? Therefore, as the initial stage of the redemption of our souls, we must cause at least 22,000 to return to the Holy Land. This is the necessary precondition for a descent of the divine presence among us. Afterward, he will grant us and all Israel additional signs of his favor." Okay, do you see what he said there? End quote. He said, he quoted the Bible, that the Lord would return unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. But on what should the divine presence rest? On sticks and stones? No, it shouldn't rest on a bare, vacant land, on rocks, on dirt, on sticks, on stones. No, the divine presence would land on people. And so he came up with the number 22,000. We must cause at least 22 Jewish people to be in the Holy Land. So God, in his presence, his Shekhinah, could come down and rest upon Jewish people. So he felt that would be a precondition for the divine presence and divine blessing coming down upon Israel. And so he began to think about getting these 22,000 Jewish people into the land. Now, during his remaining 35 years, Alkali continued to publish his ideas quite extensively. And in the end, he himself settled in Palestine as an example to others. He wanted to be one of those 22,000 people. Before his death in 1878, this energetic rabbi managed to organize a small group of followers. One of his disciples was Simon Loeb Herzl. Simon Loeb Herzl, he was the grandfather of Theodore Herzl. Let's move on to 1843. Now, Judah Alkali's views were paralleled to a remarkable degree by a contemporary, by a colleague, the Orthodox Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Now, Kalischer served a large congregation in the Polish-speaking city of Thorn in East Prussia. Kalischer enjoyed a rather substantial following, and as a result, he was given an immediate and respectful hearing. In 1843, he published his views in a two-volume work entitled Emunah Yashara, An Honest Faith. In 1862, he completed his presentation in a final volume, Drishat Zion, The Search for Zion. Now, three principal ideas were developed in these volumes, three principal thoughts. Number one, the salvation of the Jewish people, as foretold by the prophets, could take place through natural means, that is, by self-help, and did not require the event of the Messiah, the advent of the Messiah. First principal idea, and a radical idea. He justified this idea from the prophets, that the salvation of the Jews could take place through natural means, through self-help, and did not require the advent of the Messiah. Secondly, a logical deduction from this, colonization of Palestine should be launched without delay. Let's get going. If we can do it, let's get some people over to Palestine. And thirdly, his third critical idea, the revival of sacrifices in the Holy Land was permissible. Let me quote a short paragraph by Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Quote, "Pay no heed to the traditional view that the Messiah will suddenly loose a blast on the great shofar and cause all the inhabitants of the earth to tremble. On the contrary, the redemption will begin with the generation of support among philanthropists and with the gaining of the consent of the nations to the gathering of the scattered of Israel into the Holy Land." Isn't that a radical thought? Pay no heed to the traditional view that the Messiah will do all this. We need to get going and do it ourselves. We need money from philanthropists. We need political consent from nations. We can do this thing. He felt that only when pious and learned Jews volunteered to live in Jerusalem would the Creator hearken to their prayers and then speed the day of redemption. So his thinking was quite logical there. He urged four more steps to be taken in addition to these three principal ideas, four more secondary ideas. First of all, he urged that there be a formation of a society of rich Jews to undertake colonization of Zion. That's number one. Create a society of rich Jewish people who could undertake colonization. Secondly, he urged that there be a settlement by Jewish people from all backgrounds in the Holy Land, a settlement by Jews of all backgrounds on the soil of the Holy Land. Second idea. Third idea. He urged the training of young Jews in self-defense. This was some wise thinking. And fourthly, he urged the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jews might learn farming and other practical subjects. So he was a wise thinker. He thought he urged training, he urged self-defense, he urged the formation of financial resources, and he urged that all Jewish people from all over the world and all backgrounds go to the Holy Land. Some very key and very practical and very wise steps. Now, Kalischer's notion of practical messianism was appealing enough to win over a small but influential group of contemporaries who joined him. They joined him in founding a society called the Society for the Colonization of the Land of Israel. Let's move on to 1856. Now, during this this time, Jewish people were filtering back into the Holy Land. In 1856, the Jewish population exceeded 17,000 people. Not a large amount, but definitely substantial. Most of the newcomers were devoutly religious, and as a result, about one-third of them chose to settle in Jerusalem. The name attached to this 17,000 people was the name HaYishuv HaYashan, the old settlement, Hayishuv Hayashan. Their motivation was the sacred mission, a sacred mission of living, worshiping, and dying in the Holy Land on holy soil. Now, few of the Jews in Jerusalem or elsewhere were self-supporting. They depended heavily on the charitable giving, the generosity of Jews abroad. By the 1860s, the systematic collection and distribution of these gifts amounted to half the income of the Jerusalem Jews and a third of the income for the rest of the Jewish people living in Palestine. This system of charity became known as the Chalukah division, Chalukah. Now, during this time, a tremendous national awakening was sweeping Europe. Rabbi Kalischer wrote in one of his articles, "All the other peoples have striven only for the sake of their own national honor. How much more should we exert ourselves? For our duty is to labor for the glory of God who chose Zion." Now, one of the most original responses to the nationalist awakening in the 19th century Europe, in 19th century Europe, was the response of Moses Hess. Let's move on then to 1862, as we begin to move toward the end of the 19th century. 1862. Moses Hess was the son of an Orthodox Jewish family in Bonn, Germany. In 1857, now, the writing of Rabbi Kalischer came to his notice. And these writings impelled Hess to begin a systematic study of Jewish history. And the result was Hess's second book. His second book that he wrote was called Rome and Jerusalem. It was published in 1862. In this book, he asserted that return to the land of Israel was indispensable if the Jews were to shed their function as an historical abnormality, if the Jews were to shed the view that they were a social parasite in the lands of other people. They had to have a land of their own, a return to Israel. Only on the ancestral soil of Israel would the Jewish labor find it possible to organize on correct socialist principles, he wrote. Hess issued the warning that a national homeland offered the Jews their last and best chance of self-transformation into a normal people. We would be freed from the very vulnerable phantom status that historically had provoked anti-Semitism. Phantom status. We were not really a nation, not really a people, living this odd, abnormal people living in the midst of others that had historically provoked anti-Semitism. Now, the book Rome and Jerusalem ignited no fires in the Jewish world, not in 1862. Only 200 copies of the work were sold in the 5 years after its appearance. 200 copies in 5 years. Hess's writings carried a warning that more than Jewish religious or national ideals awaited fulfillment in Palestine. Sheer physical existence, in his mind, sheer physical existence was at stake. He insisted, and I quote, "We shall always remain strangers among the nations. And so if we remain strangers among the nations, the risk of Israel being, the Jewish people being totally destroyed, was very, very good." Let's move on to 1869, and Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven, is purchased in 1869. Now, during this period of time, doubts were accumulating regarding the viability of the Chalukah system. The Chalukah system, remember, was critical in supporting the Orthodox settlers in Palestine. Men of unquestioned Orthodox persuasion began to see the Chalukah charity system as detrimental both to reverence and to survival. Now, in 1869, the leader of this group, Joel Moish Solomon and six friends purchased a tract of land outside the city wall of Jerusalem. It was later entitled Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven. and this purchase of land represented Jerusalem Jewry's first voluntary, self-financed undertaking beyond the ancient Jewish quarter. It was a great step forward, and great step forward in independence. Let's move on to 1870. Mikvah Yisrael is founded in 1870. Now, if you'll think back to my remarks about Rabbi Kalischer, you'll recall that he advocated the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jewish people might learn farming and other practical subjects. At Kalischer's initiative, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, a renowned French-Jewish philanthropy, provided the initial subsidy for a Jewish agricultural school in the Holy Land. It was established near Jaffa in 1870 and called Mikvah Yisrael, the Hope of Israel. The school would eventually come to have a lasting, positive impact on the resettlement of the land. So note this name, Mikvah Yisrael. It will crop up again, time and time again in our study. In 1874, Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer died. All right, at this point, let's take a look at the late 1870s. Now, by the late 1870s, Zionist study circles and clubs had begun to function in the hundreds in Russia. Some called themselves parties or assemblies. They were all generally known as Chovevi Zion, the Lovers of Zion. You'll hear them referred to by the synonymous term Chibat Zion, which means love of Zion. So Chovevi Zion, Lovers of Zion, or Chibat Zion, synonymous terms for the same groups. Now, while the terms are essentially synonymous, there was a distinction between these two groups. Chibat Zion is a term that primarily identifies the ideology, the philosophy, while Chovevi Zion primarily identifies the people who held this philosophy. And the Chibat Zion was to love Zion. The Chovevi Zion were the ones who were the lovers of Zion. Now, their common ingredient was the acceptance of a creed. Quote, there is no salvation for the people of Israel unless they establish a government of their own in the land of Israel, end quote. Now, a few of these early groups simply offered courses in the Hebrew language and history. Others established choirs or gymnastic and self-defense organizations. The meetings were conducted secretly. For Zionism, like other varieties of minority nationalism, was very, very illegal, quite illegal in Tsarist Russia, in the Tsarist Empire. Now, at this time, there was no central direction to the Chovevi Zion cause. It existed. There were many of these little assemblies or parties around, but they had no unifying organizing factor. In 1875, Mea Shearim, which means 100 gates, Mea Shearim was purchased in the land of Israel. I see that our time is beginning to run out for this session, so we'll pick up our session with session number 5. We'll continue on in the late 1870s, and we'll pick up with the founding of Petach Tikva on our next session.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.